Good day, good day, and welcome, O denizens of Thunderbird Radio Land, as we wander once again through life's garden. Time now for the Eclectic Lunch, right here on CITR, broadcasting from the picturesque promontory known as Ulksen, a land traditionally shared by the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people, and now home to the Point Grey campus of the University of British Columbia. It's a radio drama show today. We're going to go back in time to the Golden Age, when radio was called Theater of the Mind. I was going through my vinyl collection and I came across this record. It was made in 1975, and it's two Conan stories written by Robert E. Howard. Conan, of course, is the character made famous by Arnold Schwarzenegger in two movies in the 80s, Conan the Barbarian and Conan the Destroyer. But Conan the character is much older than that. In fact, he first appeared 100 years ago in the pulp magazine Weird Tales back in 1924. And if you want to know more about the man who created Conan, there's a movie from 1996 with Vincent D'Onofrio and Renee Zellweger called The Whole Wide World. It's definitely worth checking out. Anyway, back to the story. 50 years after Conan first appeared, two of those original stories were dramatized for a record narrated by Owen McGee and featuring Paul Falzone as Conan. And we're going to hear one of them now. So get your cocoa, get an easy chair, sit back and relax, close your eyes, and hear, adapted for radio by Roy Thomas, the original story by Robert E. Howard. This is The Tower of the Elephant.
Torches flared murkily in the section of the city known as the Mall, where all the robbers and cutthroats of the East held carnival by night. In the Mall, they could carouse and roar as they liked, for honest men shunned that quarter of the city of thieves, and watchmen, well paid with stained coins, did not interfere with their sport. Along the crooked, unpaved streets, with their heaps of refuse and puddles, drunken revelers staggered. Torchlight looked luridly from broken windows and wide-thrown doors, and out of those doors, rushing like a blow in the face, came the clamor of drinking jacks and fists hammered on rough tables. In one of those dens, merriment thundered to the low, smoke-stained roof as rascals gathered in every stage of rags and tatters. Furtive cut purses, leering kidnappers, quick-fingered thieves, swaggering bravos with their winches. Native Zamorian robes were the dominant element, but there were human wolves there of half a dozen outland nations as well. And the fat, gross rogue whose bawdy jests were causing all the shouts of mirth was a professional kidnapper come up from distant Koth to teach woman stealing to Zamorians, who were born with more knowledge of the art than he could ever attain.
By Bell, God of all thieves, I'll show you how to steal wenches. I'll have her over the border before dawn where there's a caravan waiting to receive her. 300 pieces of silver, a count of warfare promised me for a sleek young Brethunian of a better class. And is she a pretty baggage? Ah-ha! I know Lord Zenshem, who would trade the secret of the Elephant Tower for her.
A touch on his sleeve made the bloated Carthian turn his head, scowling.
What the devil?
A tall, strongly made youth stood beside him, a man as much out of place in that den as a gray wolf among the mangy rats of the gutter. His cheap tunic could not conceal the hard, rangy lines of his powerful frame, the broad, heavy shoulders, the massive, lean waist and heavy arms. His skin was brown from outland suns, his eyes blue and smoldering, a shock of tousled black hair crowning his broad forehead, and at his side hung a sword in a worn leather scabbard.
You spoke of the Elephant Tower a moment ago. I've heard much of his tower. What is its secret?
The secret of the Elephant Tower? Why, any fool knows that Yara the priest dwells there with a great jewel that men call the Elephant's Heart. That is the secret of his magic.
I have seen this tower. It is set in a great garden above the level of the city, surrounded by high walls. But I've seen no guards, and the walls would be easy to climb. Why hasn't someone stolen this gem if it's so powerful?
Hearken to this heathen! He would steal the jewel of Yara! Hearken, fellow. I suppose you're some sort of northern barbarian.
I am a Sumerian.
Well, listen to me and learn something. Know that in Zamora, and most especially in the city of Thebes, there are more bold robbers than anywhere else in the world, even Koth. If mortal man could have stolen that gem, be sure it would have been filched long ago.
But if a man could pass through the gardens, why could he not reach the gem through the upper part of the tower, and thus avoid not only the soldiers, but this Yara also?
Listen to him! The barbarian is an eagle who can fly to the jeweled rim of the tower, which is only 150 feet above the earth, with rounded sides slicker than polished glass. Come, tell these poor fellows who've only been thieves since before you were spawned. Tell them how you would steal the gem.
There is always a way, if the desire be coupled with courage.
What? You dare tell me my business and then intimate that I'm a coward? Get along! Get out of my sight!
Will you mock me and then lay hands on me?
His quick rage leaping up, the barbarian returned the Kothian shove with an open-handed blow that sent his tormentor sprawling, pulling at his sword.
You heathen dog! I'll have your heart out for that!
Steel flashed, and the throng surged wildly back out of the way. In their flight, they knocked over the single candle that lit the place, and the den was plunged into darkness. And the candle was relighted. The barbarian was gone, and the center of the room was deserted except for the gashed, lifeless body of the Kothian. The Sumerian, with the unerring instinct of the barbarian, had killed his man in the darkness and confusion. The lurid lights and drunken revelry fell away behind the Sumerian. He had discarded his torn tunic and walked through the night naked except for a loincloth and high-strapped sandals. He moved with the supple ease of a great tiger, his steely muscles rippling under his bronzed skin. At length, he saw it looming ahead of him against the sky, the Tower of the Elephant. For a passing moment, he wondered why it was so named. No one seemed to know. He had never seen an elephant, but a wandering Shemite had sworn to him that it was a monstrous animal with a tail in front as well as behind. But all men know what liars are the men of Shem. The tower itself rose frostily beneath the stars, a round, slim, perfect cylinder 150 feet in height, standing among the waving, exotic trees of a garden enclosed by a great high wall. No light shone forth, and only a rim of great jewels high above sparkled in the moonlight. Conan halted before the wall. He knew it would be child's play to scale, but he hesitated at the thought of Yara, the high priest who lived somewhere within the tower. At last, curiosity overcame the barbarian, and leaping lightly, he was over the wall in an instant. Inside, the starlight fell on the grassy sward, and somewhere a fountain tinkled. Drawing his sword, he made for the nearby shrubbery, only to nearly trip over a form that lay crumpled near the edge of the bushes.
Crom, a guard. He's been strangled. The body's still warm.
The barbarian glanced about uneasily. Suddenly, straining his eyes through the gloom, he saw a hint of motion through the shrubs near the wall. He glided toward it, making no more noise than a panther stealing through the night. Yet the man he was stalking heard. He wheeled quickly, blade in hand. For a tense moment, neither spoke, standing ready for anything.
You are no soldier. You're a thief like myself.
And who are you?
Taurus of Nemedia.
Ah, I've heard of you. Men call you a prince of thieves.
And rightly so. Now, who the devil are you?
I am Conan, a Sumerian. I came seeking a way to steal Yara's jewel, the one men call the Elephant's Heart.
By Belgod of Thieves, I thought that only myself had courage enough to attempt that bit of poaching. Conan, I like your grit. And by Bell, we'll attempt this together, if you're willing.
I'll go as far as any man.
Then follow me.
The Nemedian thief led the barbarian to a second inner wall. This they both scaled easily and dropped down into the inner garden, which was a vague pool of shadows beneath the moon.
Keep behind me, Cimmerian, as you value your life.
Taking a copper tube from his belt, the Nemedian fixed his gaze on the shadowy mass of shrubbery a few yards away. The shrubbery was suddenly shaken, although the breeze had died down. Then two great eyes blazed out from the darkness, and behind them, other sparks of fire glinted through the black.
Lions! There are five in sight, maybe more, back in the bushes.
Be silent.
Taurus moved out from the wall, cautiously lifting the slender copper tube. Low rumblings rose from the shadows. As the blazing eyes moved forward, Conan could sense the great slavering jaws. He gripped his sword, expecting the sudden charge, the loud roar, and the irresistible hurtling of giant bodies. Just then, Taurus brought the mouth of the copper tube to his lips and blew powerfully. A long jet of yellowish powder shot out from the tube and billowed instantly into a thick green-yellow cloud that settled over the shrubbery, blotting out the glaring eyes. Conan could see nothing.
What is that mist?
Death.
Soon only yellowish shreds of mist hung ghost-like in the air. Then they too were gone, and Taurus motioned his companion forward. There in the shadows lay five great tawny shapes, the fire of their grim eyes dimmed forever.
Crom, they died without a sound. Taurus, what was in that powder?
It was made for the Black Lotus. The scent strikes dead any who smell it. And that was all I possessed. Up at Common Bell's name. How are we to waste the night in discussion? Come.
They glided through the shrubbery to the foot of the tower. There Taurus unwound the knotted cord about his waist, one end of which was a strong steel hook. He gripped the line and swung it about his head. Then he threw the line with a smooth, rippling motion of his mighty arm. Up and up it went, to vanish over the jeweled rim high above.
Ha! Luck the first cast. Now, we must climb this cord. And little need to ask a Cimmerian if he can.
If it will bear my weight.
It will bear thrice my own. It was woven from the tresses of dead women, which I took from their tombs at midnight and steeped in the deadly wine of the Upas tree to give it strength. Follow me closely.
Gripping the rope, the Nemedian ascended it like a cat. The Cimmerian followed with ease. Up and up they went. The lights of the city spread out further and further to their sight as they climbed. Now Taurus reached the top and pulled himself up and over the rim. Conan paused a moment as he did the same, fascinated by the great frosty jewels whose gleams dazzled his barbarian eyes.
Oh, there's a fabulous fortune in jewels here.
Come on, come on. If we secure the heart, these and all other things shall be ours. Follow me. Now is when the real risks begin.
Like stalking tigers, they crept across the dark, gleaming floor to a sparkling, bejeweled door. It opened soundlessly to Taurus' cautious hand. Over the Nemedian's shoulder, Conan had a glimpse of walls, ceiling, and floors inside, all crusted with great white jewels.
I'll go first, lad. You follow me in a moment.
Stealthily, Taurus entered. Then suddenly...
Taurus! Taurus!
Taurus swayed and his lips parted, but only a dry rattle burst from his throat. He lurched forward, then fell headlong, clutching at his throat. Then he suddenly stiffened, and Conan knew without touching him that Taurus was dead. Crouching like a wolf at bay, Conan stared through the wide-flung door, but he saw nothing moving inside. He turned back to the dead Nemedian.
No mark of violence, except here on his neck, three small wounds with black edges.
Cautiously, Conan stole into the chamber, all but ignoring the jewels which lay strewn within. Then suddenly, death struck at him. A flying shadow swept across the gleaming floor. Only the barbarian's instinctive sidelong leap had saved his life. Conan had a flashing glimpse of a hairy black horror that rushed past him with a clashing of frothing fangs, and then something splashed from his bare shoulder that burned like drops of liquid hellfire. Then turning, sword held high, he saw a gigantic black spider, such as men behold only in their deepest nightmare. A spider large as a great hound, its eight thick, hairy legs driving its horrible body over the floor at headlong pace. Its four evilly gleaming eyes shining with a frightening intelligence, its fangs dripping the deadly venom which had already burned the barbarian's shoulder.
Fools that we were not to have suspected that the upper chambers would be guarded.
Again the monster charged. Conan leaped high. It passed beneath him, wheeled, and charged back. This time as he dodged it, his sword severed one of its misshapen legs. With its seven remaining legs, the great spider ran up the wall to the ceiling to crouch for an instant, glaring down at him with fiendish red eyes. Then, without warning, it suddenly launched itself through space, cradling a strand of slimy, grayish fluid. Conan ducked frantically, barely escaping being snared by the flying web rope. He sprang toward the floor, but the spider was even quicker, and a silky strand across the far door made him a prisoner. He dared not try to cut through it, for before he could do so, the monster would be sinking its fangs into his back. And now began a deadly, desperate game. Again and again, the spider raced across the ceiling, out of sword's reach, dropping long, sticky loops of gray web strands. The strands were as thick as ropes, and Conan knew that once they were coiled about him, not all his barbarian strength would set him free before the monster struck. Then, suddenly, as the spider cast still another gruesome strand, it struck Conan's leg, knocking him off balance. He caught himself on his hands as he fell. He looked up. The hairy devil was racing down the wall to complete its conquest.
You spawn of hell!
Stung to frenzy, Conan caught up a jewel chest which lay at hand and hurled it with all of his might. In the midst of those branching black legs, it struck. Blood and greenish slime spattered, and the broken mass fell to the floor. The crushed black body lay among the flaming riot of jewels that spilled over it. Those great hairy legs moved aimlessly, twitched a final time, and then were still. Working free of the web, he cut through the strands which sealed the inner door and turned the latch. It was not locked. Inside, he saw only a flight of silver steps, dimly lighted and leading downward. Noiselessly, he began to descend them. Presently, he came to a gleaming white door set with bloodstones. Carefully, he pressed against the door and it swung silently inward. On the shimmering threshold, Conan stared like a wolf at bay. He was looking into a large chamber with a domed golden ceiling. The walls were of green jade, the floor of silver white, partly covered with thick rugs. Smoke and the exotic scent of incense floated up from a brazier, and behind it sat an idol on a marble couch. Conan stared aghast. The image had the body of a man, naked and green in color, but the head... The head was one of nightmare and madness. It was too large for the human body, nor did it look at all human. Conan stared at the wide, flaring ears, the curling tentacle where a nose should have been, the white tusks tipped with round golden balls. The eyes of the statue were closed as if in sleep.
Krong, take me. So this is the reason it's called the Tower of the Elephant. This is Yara's god.
Conan moved forward slowly, his eyes fixed on the motionless idol. Then, suddenly, its eyes opened. The Cimmerian froze in his tracks. This was no idol. It was a living thing, and he was trapped in its chamber. Conan stood stark, still, unable to move, even to flee in his horror, as the trunk of the thing was lifted and quested about. The topaz eyes of the monster stared uneasily, and Conan knew that they were blind. Yet the creature heard.
Who is here? Yara, have you come to torture me again? Will you never be done? Oh, Yargosha, is there no end of agony?
Great tears rolled from the sightless eyes, and as Conan's gaze strayed to the monster's limbs, he knew it would not rise to attack him. For he saw on those limbs the mark of the rack and the searing brand of flame, and suddenly all fear and repulsion went from him to be replaced by a great pity. What this creature was, Conan could not know, but its suffering seemed so terrible that a strange, aching sadness came over the Cimmerian, he knew not why. He felt only that he was looking upon a cosmic tragedy, and he shrank with shame as if the guilt of the whole human race were laid upon him.
I am not Yara. I'm only a thief. I will not harm you.
Come near that I may touch you. You are not of Yara's race of devils. The clean, lean fierceness of the wasteland mocks you. There is blood on your fingers.
A spider in the chamber above.
You have slain a man too this night. And there is death in the tower above. I feel, I know.
Aye, the prince of all thieves lies dead there from the bite of the spider.
Ah, so and so. A slaying in the tavern and a slaying on the roof. I know, I feel. And the third slaying will make the magic of which not even Yara dreams. Oh, magic of deliverance. Oh, great green gods of Yogg. Listen, oh man. I am foul and monstrous to you, am I not? Nay, do not answer, I know. But you would seem as strange to me could I see you. There are many worlds besides this earth, and life takes many shapes. I am neither god nor demon, but flesh and blood like yourself, though the substance and the form be different.
Then whence did you come?
I am very old, man of the far countries. Long and long ago, I came to this planet with others of my world from the great green planet Yogg, which circles forever on the outer fringes of this universe. We swept through the ether on mighty wings that drove us through the cosmos more quickly than light. But we could never return, for on Earth our wings withered from our shoulders. Here we abode apart from the earthly life. We saw men grow from the ape and build the shining cities. We saw the very oceans arise and engulf Atlantis. We saw new savages drift over the land to build a new civilization. And we saw this race of devils, the survivors of the ancient culture that was before Atlantis sank, rise once more into civilization and power. This accursed kingdom of Zamora. All this we saw, neither aiding nor hindering the immutable cosmic law, and one by one we died. For we of Yogg are not immortal, though our lives are as the lives of planets and stars. At last I alone was left, dreaming of old times among the ruined temples, worshipped as a god by an ancient race. Then came Yara. Yara, versed in dark knowledge. With guile gotten among the dusky tombs of Stygia, he tricked me into divulging a secret I had not intended to bear. And turning my power upon me, he enslaved me. Ah, gods of Yogg, my cup has been bitter since that hour.
Again tears stole from the unseeing eyes as Conan stood unmoving.
He pent me in this tower, which at his command I built for him in a single night. By fire and rack he mastered me, and for 300 years he has kept me alive to do his bidding, blackening my soul with cosmic sins that have no name. Yet not all my ancient secrets has he wrested from me. And my last gift shall be the sorcery of the blood and the jewel. For I feel the end of time draw near. You, man of Cimmeria, are the hand of fate. I beg of you, take the gem you will find on yonder altar.
The heart of the elephant.
Ah, the great magic. The mighty magic such as Earth has not seen before and shall not see again. Take your sword, O man, and cut out my heart. Then squeeze it so that the blood will flow over the red stone. Then go you down these stairs and into the ebony chamber where Yara sits wrapped in lotus dreams of evil. Speak his name and he will awaken. Then lay this gem before him and say, Yogg Kosher gives you a last gift and a last enchantment. Then get you quickly from the tower. Fear not, your way shall be made clear.
I will do as you say.
The life of man is not the life of Yogg. nor is human death the death of Yogg. Let me be free of this cage of broken, blinded flesh, and I will once more be morning-crowned and shining with wings to fly and feet to dance and eyes to see. And now, man of Cimmeria, strike! Strike home!
Uncertainly, Conan approached, and Yogg Kosher, as if sensing his uncertainty, indicated where he should smite. Conan set his teeth and drove the sword deep. Blood streamed over the blade and his hand, and the monster started convulsively, then lay back quite still. Sure that life had fled, at least life as he understood it, Conan set to work on his grisly task and quickly brought forth something that he felt must be the strange being's heart. Holding the still pulsing organ over the blazing jewel, he pressed it with both hands and a rain of blood fell on the stone.
The blood does not run off. It soaks into the gem.
Then, holding the jewel carefully, he strode from the fantastic chamber and without hesitation descended the silver steps. At last he halted before an ebony door and pushed it open. There, amid a chamber of ebony, on a black silken couch, Yara the sorcerer lay before him. His eyes were open and dilated with the fumes of the yellow lotus, as if fixed on gulfs and nighted abysses beyond human ken.
Yara, awaken! He who sent this gem bade me say, Yogg Kosher gives a last gift and a last enchantment.
Ishtar!
Yara recoiled, his dark face suddenly ashen. The jewel was no longer crystal clear. Its murky depths pulsed and throbbed, and curious waves of changing color passed over its smooth surface. As if drawn hypnotically, Yara gripped the gem in his hand, staring into its shadowed recesses, and as Conan watched, he thought his eyes must be playing him tricks, for with a shock he realized that the once tall priest was shrinking in stature and growing smaller before his very eyes. Conan knew only that he was looking upon the meeting of vast outer forces beyond his understanding, and now the sorcerer suddenly realized his fate.
No!
For already he was no bigger than a child. Now, like an infant sprawled on the table, he sprang up, releasing the gem to fall. But still he dwindled, and Conan saw a tiny doll-like figure rushing wildly about the ebony tabletop, waving tiny arms and shrieking in a voice he could hardly hear.
Help me! Oh, ye gods! Help me!
Now he had shrunk until the great jewel towered above him like a hill, and Conan sensed that some unseen magnetic force was pulling Yara to the gem. Bending close, Conan saw Yara give in to that force and clamber up the smooth, curving surface, impossibly, like a man climbing a glass mountain. Now the priest stood at last on the top, still with tossing arms, invoking grisly names which only he and the gods knew. And suddenly he sank into the very heart of the jewel as a man sinks into the sea.
By Grom!
Now he saw Yara inside the jewel, which was once more crystal clear, and into the heart came a green, shining, winged figure with the body of a man and the head of an elephant. Yogg Kosher, but no longer blind and crippled. Yara threw up his arms and fled as a madman flees, and on his heels came the avenging Yogg Kosher. Then, like the bursting of a bubble, the green jewel vanished in a rainbow burst of iridescent gleams, and the ebony tabletop lay bare and deserted. As bare, Conan somehow knew, as the marble couch in the chamber above where the body of Yogg Kosher had lain. The Cimmerian turned then and fled from the chamber down the silver stairs. Down that winding, shadowy stair he ran to come at last into a large chamber where several Cimmerian soldiers slumped across a banquet board among their dice and fallen goblets. Conan knew at once that they were dead. The promise had been made, the word kept, and a silver door stood open, framed in the whiteness of dawn. Into the waving green gardens ran Conan, and as the dawn wind blew upon him, he started like a man waking from a dream. He turned back to stare at the great tower he had just left. But even as he looked, he saw the gleaming tower sway against the crimson dawn, its jeweled, frosted rim sparkling in the glowing light. Million shining shards.
Grom.
Don't touch that dial. Because right after these messages, for the rest of the hour, we've got stories from Ripley's Believe It or Not.
I'm Walter Cronkite. I'd like you to hear something. Any way you want it, that's the way you need it. Any way you want it. They're radio hams, amateurs, giving of their own time and spending their own money.
CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Your volunteer-run station.
They're just two average guys who saw the need and volunteered.
Known pimp, narcotics king, big time racketeer, back in full force.
This could be one of the big moments in your life. Don't make it your last.
Look, this thing might be bigger than even we think it is.
Do you need an upgrade to the soundtrack to your life? Perhaps a song from a film or a tune from TV? My name is Gap. Exploding Head Movies is here to give you sounds from the cinema, along with the songs that will be defining your future, and those forgotten classics that need a little rescue.
Yeah. Come on, baby. Come on. I won't let you down. Follow me.
Exploding Head Movies, Monday, 7 to 9 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Old or New Testament?
I think the New Testament.
The question is, Pilate, you remember Pilate from the New Testament?
Pontius Pilate, he fiddled well.
Yeah, no, well, just a minute. Let me ask the question, then you can give me the answer, okay? Did Pilate want Jesus to be crucified?
Pontius Pilate washed his hands of it.
So did he want him to be crucified?
Yeah.
No. No. No.
Well, tune in every Friday afternoon, 3:30 to the Night Watch Show on Sunday.
Well, find a good church. It'll help you.
Join us every other Wednesday from 6:30 to 8 p.m. for Sam Squanch's Hideaway with your host, Anita B., as she plays all Canadian music with a focus on indie rock and pop.
Now, you probably recognize the name, believe it or not. There was a Bruce Campbell TV series on the Travel Channel, and then a few years before that, there was one with Dean Cain. There's museums all over the country, all over the world, in fact, including the Ripley's Museum in Niagara Falls. But back in the 30s, Ripley's Believe It or Not was a one-panel comic strip and a radio show. And it told stories of bizarre events, unusual items, and strange coincidences that challenge you to believe it or not. So we've got some segments from that radio show from around 1930, 1935. Anyway, hope you enjoy it.
Boss Bran Flakes present Believe It or Not. Flakes, the delicious cereal that's more than a cereal, bring you Robert Ripley with more of his amazing Believe It or Not, B.A. Rolfe and his orchestra, and lovely Linda Lee. Yes, sir, life is swell when you keep well. And what a really swell cereal Post 40% Bran Flakes are. A wonderful flavor, nut-like and crunchy. And then, in addition, this delicious cereal has those extra benefits. The benefits of Bran, so many of you need to help you keep fit naturally. So first thing, why don't you join the millions who enjoy Post Bran Flakes every day? And here's that welcome-worthy, wonder-working winner of well-founded, warranted, worldwide wows, Believe It or Not, Bob Ripley.
Greetings, everybody, and welcome to the program tonight.
Bob Ripley, that problem you gave me last week certainly has me all mixed up.
What do you mean, then?
Remember, you asked me what war ended 30 years before it started.
Oh, yes, that was a war between the Mozabites and the French in North Africa in 1880. Linda, just as the war was about to break out, the French diplomats urged them to stop and avoid useless bloodshed. But the Mozabites said that they'd never started anything unless they finished it, and they always finished every war they started. Now, in order to satisfy everybody, the French and the natives signed a paper, now in the records of the French War Ministry, stating that the war had ended 30 years before it started, believe it or not. I know it's hard for us to believe that only 100 years ago, the crimes of forgery and counterfeiting were punishable by death. Now, my first radio drama tonight deals with the most fantastic counterfeiting case that has ever come to my attention. The time, August the 9th, 1828. The place, the gloomy criminal court of Old Bailey in London. The defendant, John Lloyd, who's on trial for forgery and possession of counterfeit money, is whispering to his solicitor, Mr. Hunt.
But Mr. Rogers, I told him I got those banknotes honestly.
Both Mr. Glover and myself realize that you're innocent, John, but we haven't got the evidence to prove it.
What are you going to do? Let me, an innocent man, go to the gallows?
Easy, lad. You're not on the gallows yet. There's still a trump to be played. Mr. Glover is going to try and confuse the Crown's witness.
You mean Henry Hayes? He's a wise one, he is. How'll you do it?
We shall ask him to identify again each and every one of those counterfeit £5 notes which they hold in evidence against you.
What good's that going to do?
You see, lad, the barrister realizes things look pretty black for you, and he knows you're innocent. He's done a desperate thing.
What's he done?
He's actually tampered with King's evidence.
No.
He's substituted a genuine £5 note for one of the counterfeits. If Mr. Hayes identifies that genuine note as counterfeit, it will discredit him as an expert witness, and the case against you will collapse. Listen, Mr. Glover's about to begin cross-examination.
Mr. Glover, you may proceed with the cross-examination of the Crown witness, Henry Hayes.
Thank you, my lord. Now, Mr. Hayes, as cashier of the Bank of England, you have previously testified that these Bank of England notes, 10 in number and of £5 denomination, are forgeries. I refer, of course, to Exhibit A.
I did so testify.
Would you be obliging enough to explain how you arrived at that conclusion? You're aware, of course, that a man's life is at stake.
There is no doubt in my mind that they're forgeries.
You are prepared to swear again that each and every one of these banknotes in Exhibit A is a forgery?
I am.
Then I call upon you to restate your opinion of these banknotes under oath. I give them to you now for re-examination.
I have done this already. It is ridiculous.
The court wishes to instruct the witness that Mr. Glover is within his rights in insisting upon your re-examination of the notes.
Very well, then. I'll take them. Let me see. The first note. Obvious forgery. Second. Likewise. Third. Likewise. Fourth. Strange.
Go on, Mr. Hayes.
I beg pardon, my lord. May I request that the bailiff hand me the magnifying glass in my cloak?
The court so directs.
Mr. Rogers, I told you it was foolish to try and trip him up. Mr. Hayes is a wise old fox. I can feel that noose tight around my neck now. I wouldn't give you tuppence for my life.
Mr. Glover.
Wait, listen.
You may resume cross-examination of the Crown witness.
Thank you, my lord. Well, Mr. Hayes, you seem perturbed. What strange mystery did your magnifying glass disclose when you examined that banknote?
Mr. Glover, this note is genuine. It's very strange.
Genuine, eh? I see, Mr. Hayes, the fate of my poor defendant has now suddenly begun to concern you. Can it be possible you made a mistake in your first examination?
No, but, my lord, with the court's permission, I would like to confer for a moment with the counsel for the Bank of England.
Very well, Mr. Hayes. Permission is granted.
Look, John, we've got him on the run.
You're right. He does look green about the gills. I wonder what's up.
I'm ready, my lord.
Court recognizes Mr. Hayes. Proceed.
The Bank of England wishes to withdraw all charges preferred against the accused
John Lloyd. Order in the court! Order in the court!
The court has no choice but to grant this motion. But before it makes its rule definite, the court wishes to question the Crown witness, Mr. Henry Hayes.
Yes, my lord?
What has prompted this sudden reversal of attitude on your part?
I'm still dazed, my lord. What has happened, I cannot yet believe. When I examined this £5 note a moment ago, I found it to be genuine.
You already testified to that effect?
Yes, my lord. But there was something else. There is writing on it. Writing in blood.
Did you say in blood?
Yes. Written on this £5 note is a message for help. It reads as follows. I am writing this with a splinter of wood dipped in my own blood. If this note should fall into friendly hands, let it be known that I have been languishing in a slave galley in Algeria, in the cruel services of Hussein Pasha. Please help
me. Mr. Hayes, why are you so deeply concerned about this?
My lord, the man who signed the message on this banknote has been missing for 13 years. He is Samuel Hayes, my brother.
The wildest flight of fancy could never contrive a situation more dramatic or more unbelievable than this. The lawyer's trick in substituting a genuine £5 note for a counterfeit brought to light a message written in blood by the long-lost brother of the Crown witness. And so, two human lives were saved by a banknote, the life of the defendant in the case, and that of the long-lost brother who was traced to the English consul in Algiers and ransomed from slavery. The note itself is now an exhibit in the Bank of England Museum in London. Believe it or not. Probably the most cussed and discussed subject in the world today is the weather, and we have had plenty of it lately. But we really shouldn't complain about the weather. We have had worse. Why, the year 1866 was known as a year without a summer. All along the Atlantic coast, they had snow, sleet, rain, and cold all summer long. In July, birds froze to death in the fields and forests, crops never came up, and not a single fruit tree bore fruit all year long. But the like of it has never happened since. But the most dismal of all days within the memory of man was the famous dark day of 1790. On May the 19th, midday was as black as midnight, and it wasn't due to any eclipse of the sun at all, but was caused by a mysterious formation of heavy black clouds. Roosters failed to crow, all animals remained asleep, and people actually carried lanterns down Broadway at noontime. We really didn't have a bad storm this week. Why, when I was in the Philippines, I came across a place where the greatest of all storms took place. This was a real flood. On July the 14th, 1911, 46 inches of rain fell in 24 hours in Baguio, not far from Manila. That means that more rain fell in Baguio in one day than usually falls in Los Angeles in 3 years. 26 years ago, next Thursday, the greatest tragedy in the history of the sea occurred. On the night of April the 14th, 1912, a wireless message crackled across the ocean announcing that the Titanic, hailed as the safest ship afloat, was sinking. That message was received by a young Marconi operator sitting alone in his little wireless station in New York City. This operator was the first to receive and to send out this disastrous message to the world, the sinking of the Titanic with a loss of 1,518 lives. President Taft in Washington even ordered all wireless stations silenced so this voyage could continue receiving messages from the rescue ships. and he performed this heroic task. He stayed at his wireless key for 72 hours at a stretch without relief. This coming week, being the anniversary of the Titanic disaster, I think it fitting to pay tribute to this boy of 26 years ago. That wireless operator was none other than David Sarnoff, now president of the Radio Corporation of America and chairman of the board of the National Broadcasting Company, believe it or not. For my next believe it or not, I take you back over 40 years to 1896 in Port Hope, Michigan. It's just before dinner at the home of the Shoebrings. The children are playing an exciting game when the mother calls to them.
Dinner'll be ready in a second, just as soon as I get this bread cut.
All right, Mother.
We're on a bear hunt.
Yippee, look out, Mr. Bear. Woo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo, here we come.
Children, how can I cut bread with you under my feet? Come out from under that table, Arthur.
That isn't a table, Mother. That's a big cave. And it isn't Arthur. He's a bear.
Yippee, look out, Mr. Bear. Here we come. Look out, Arthur.
Oh, my darling. What have I done?
What's the matter, Mother? What's the matter with Arthur?
He jumped out from under the table, and this bread knife went right into his eye.
And the little boy who was playing a game with his brother and sister that evening is here with us tonight to tell us the strange conclusion to that accident. Mr. Arthur Shoebring, I can't think of anything more terrifying than a bread knife going into an eye.
It's the best thing that ever happened to me.
What, a knife in your eye?
Yes, Mr. Ripley. You see, before my accident, I was so cross-eyed that I was very miserable. The bread knife must have cut a muscle, and it straightened out my eyes. Now my eyes are perfectly normal.
Yes, that's right. Your eyes are. They're not cross-eyed anymore, I'm sure. Thank you, Mr. Shoebring. Ladies and gentlemen, I think you'll agree that that was a lucky accident. Arthur Shoebring, who was cross-eyed when a little boy, accidentally ran into a bread knife his mother was holding, and that accident straightened out his crossed eyes. Believe it or not. Well, on the subject of lucky accidents, I have a young man standing here beside me whom I'd like to question. His name is Robert Merrill. He came here from Crane, Missouri. Mr. Merrill, tell us, where were you on October the 16th, 1931?
I was out hunting with a rifle.
And what happened?
As I was running across the field, I tripped and fell. The gun went off and the bullet went right through my side.
That's terrible.
Oh, no, Mr. Ripley, that bullet did me a favor.
A favor?
Yes. When I got to the hospital, the doctors told me that the bullet had clipped off my appendix clean as a whistle.
Well, that was a lucky bullet, I must say. Ladies and gentlemen, you've just heard from Robert Merrill, who was out hunting and stumbled and fell while carrying a rifle. The rifle went off and the bullet went completely through his right side. But instead of hurting him, the bullet miraculously cut off his appendix with surgical precision. Believe it or not. This being the night of lucky accidents, I have also invited Mr. Joe Fleischman from Jackson, Michigan, to come here and tell us about his accident. Now, tell us what happened to you, Mr. Fleischman.
I was smoking a pipe, Mr. Ripley.
Well, that's good.
No, that was bad. Because I was fixing a tire at the same time.
Oh, and that was bad.
No, that was good, because the tire exploded in my face.
Well, what's good about that?
When the tire exploded in my face, it drove the pipe stem right down my throat.
Oh, I suppose that was just dandy.
It was. You see, I had some trouble with my tonsils.
Good or bad?
Don't worry. It all ended happily, Mr. Ripley. The tire exploded in my face and drove the pipe stem down my throat. And that pipe stem cut off my tonsils completely and free of charge.
Free of charge? Believe it or not. The Ladies and gentlemen, you've just heard of three lucky, believe it or not, accidents with a purpose. You've heard Arthur Shoebring, who got a knife in the eye and straightened out his cross eyes. Robert Merrill, who tripped over a rifle, which went off, the bullet removing his appendix. Joe Fleischman, who had a pipe stem driven down his throat, which removed his tonsils, proving that the worst that can happen to you is for the best. Or truth is stranger than fiction. Believe it or not.
Thank you, everybody, and thanks, B.A.
Say, Linda, you're certainly in a dancing mood tonight, all right.
Uh-huh. I'm looking at the world through rose-colored glasses.
Well, there's no better way of looking at it, Linda. You know, folks, it's a mighty rosy old world when you're feeling tops. Yes, life is swell when you keep well. So why not keep on feeling that way? And here's a good recipe. Plenty of fresh air and sunshine. The right kind of exercise. Get sleep enough. And enjoy the right foods. At breakfast, enjoy the cereal that's more than a cereal. The cereal that brings you a marvelous flavor and the benefits of bran. Post bran flakes. And here's another recipe. I wonder how many of you know just how good bran muffins can be. Well, you'll find a recipe on your package of Post bran flakes that'll make just the finest bran muffins you ever put in your mouth. Moist, tender, full of flavor. And you'll find bran muffins a splendid way for you to vary your use of Post bran flakes. So ask your grocer for Post bran flakes. Join the millions of folks who get off each day to a sensible start with Post bran flakes. Yes, sir, life is swell when you keep well.
Bob, what's the big question tonight?
Well, Linda, tonight, here's the question. Now, tell me, in what country are animals obliged to wear veils?
I know that veils are all the rage this spring, but I didn't know that our four-footed friends wore them.
Well, there is a country where the animals wear veils, Linda. And if you don't find out by next Saturday, Vale, I'll tell you.
This is Ford Bond saying good night and keep fit for the makers of Post bran flakes. This is the National Broadcasting Company.
On the Eclectic Lunch today, we heard The Tower of the Elephant by Robert E. Howard and selected pieces from Robert Ripley's Believe It or Not from the 1930s. Our theme music is by Ry Cooter, and this little ditty is by the great Neil Hefti. If there's something you'd like to hear on Eclectic Lunch, drop us a line at daveradiopodcast@hotmail.com. You can search out our podcast archive at citr.ca, and remember to like, share, and subscribe, because Sharon deserves it. Keep your dial set on CITR all afternoon. Chopped and Screwed, the show for all things sampling, is up next. That's followed at 2 by Radio Art from Beppe Crespin. And as he's always been, since 1987, our very own star in the BC Entertainment Walk of Fame, Nardwar the Human Serviette at 3:30. We'll be back with more delightful morsels on the Eclectic Lunch next week at this same time. We now return you to regular programming.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded, Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Nisiam, Nisiaya, Thinkum Queen Ansep, Hydra CM, Nisiam, Nisiaya, Anthas Yakuya, Talitin, Homasque Mustail.